intense heat and pressure, and now the biggest pressure of their lives. For most of these women, maybe all, their most important penalty kicks ever. The shot! Saves going! Sundlund's shot, and she scores, even up again, but it also means that the USA could win the World Cup on this next kick. Chastain will take it. Second time the United States has won the Women's World Cup, and Brandi Chastain gets the game winner in the PK.
The Women's Football Podcast,
shining a light on the women's game.
So welcome to this very special 99ers edition of the Women's Football Podcast, where we will be looking back at the Women's World Cup from 1999, 15 years on from that very special day when Brandi Chastain scored the winning penalty against China. Now, to do a special show, I need a special person to help me along with this, and I thought, who better than a current player playing out in the US, an international, a midfield dynamo for the Washington Spirit. I am joined by former guest on the show and friend of the show, Yael Averbuch. Yael, how are you?
Hi, I'm good. Thanks so much for having me on. I'm honoured.
I'm more honoured than you are, believe me. I'm in the presence of an international footballer. You are in the presence of a press officer who represents a charity in England. So I think you're probably more well known than I am. But The purpose of this show is really to have a look back at that special day and that special tournament, which created so many memories for so many different people. And for this show, Yael and I are going to have a little chat about the competition and Yael growing up and playing soccer as a youngster and how that tournament influenced her. I've also got some interviews as well. I managed to speak to the player that scored the winning penalty that won the World Cup for the US, Brandi Chastain. And I also speak to the man who oversaw the whole thing for the US. I do, of course, mean I spoke to Tony DiCicco. So when we come back, Yael and I will have a little chat before we get into our first interview.
The Women's Football Podcast would like to thank our partners. Want more women's football? Subscribe to She Kicks magazine at shekicks.net. And the Women's Football Podcast is part of the Soccer Desk Network.
TheSoccerDesk.com. So before we go into our first interview with Brandi, I want to have a little chat with Yael about what it was like for a young girl, 12 years old, growing up in Montclair, New Jersey, playing soccer. What was it like? What role models did you have? Were you aware of the 99 team at that phase, or were you just influenced by men players, or how was it at that time?
Yeah, I do remember being aware of the team leading into the World Cup. However, it was kind of a vague awareness. I think nowadays, you know, there's a lot more media and the television coverage. It's definitely a lot more out there for young players. But I do remember the lead up to the tournament, and actually the team trained in New Jersey for a little while, and I was able to go watch them train a couple times, and I was so excited. One time I got to kick the ball back to them. They were doing a shooting drill and someone missed, and I kicked the ball back. So I thought, oh, maybe they noticed my good technique. But that was around the time when I was 12, when I started to become really serious as a player, and I looked up to a lot of those players and had watched, you know, some VHS tapes featuring some of them. So I was becoming aware, and it was my goal as a player to be on the national team at that point and to play professionally. So I didn't really understand quite what that meant, but I definitely was, you know, fairly in touch with the high level of the game and those players who were my idols at that point.
What was it like for a young girl playing a sport that isn't the most recognized in the US now? It was even less recognized 15 years ago. My understanding doing my research is when you did play as a young girl, you were playing in boys' teams. How did you cope with that, knowing that you were playing or trying to make it in a sport that wasn't necessarily as recognised as bigger sports, and trying to progress and really develop as a young girl and as a player?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think as a player at that point, I wasn't quite aware of, you know, the scheme and the layout of soccer in the US at that point. All I knew was I had found this sport that was actually fairly prevalent, especially in New Jersey, for young kids, soccer was growing and becoming a lot bigger. So there was definitely a lot of programming and options for me, teams I could have played on. I did want to stay local and not travel pretty far, so I could have driven, you know, 30, 45 minutes to go play on a more elite girls team, but I made the choice in my town and drive, you know, to the park 10 minutes down the road and play on a boys team at the time, because I did need a challenge as a player who wanted to eventually be an elite player, but I wasn't really ready to make the time commitment, or at least maybe my parents weren't ready to make the time commitment to drive me to train with a more elite girls team. So yeah, I played on a boys team growing up, and it was an interesting experience, to say the least, a very awkward social experience, but I still think that was probably one of the best decisions I made as a young player in terms of just stretching myself out of my comfort, really just pushing me to see what there was ahead of my level at that current moment as a player and how much better I could be than I was right then.
I've spoken to players like Kelly Smith over here, and Kelly's told me that when she played in boys' teams when she was younger, she tended to be a lot better than most of them. And it wasn't necessarily the boys that had the problem. Quite often it was the parents of the boys, because obviously their lads were being humiliated, embarrassed by a girl who was running rings around them. Can you remember what the reaction was of number one, the other boys on the team, and the parents of those boys?
Yeah, well, the boys on my team were all great and really supportive, as were the parents. I remember, you know, if they weren't supportive, I don't know if I could have done it. But I do remember showing up a lot of times, and the team we were playing against would kind of look over, and I could tell they were thinking, you know, what the heck is she doing here? Get her off the field. We don't want to deal with that. And then the parents on the other teams would always have ridiculous comments. Like, I think one time a parent yelled out, "Oh, give her a pink card." Haha, thank you, sir. That's hilarious. And I do remember there weren't so many awkward moments, but there was one time I was playing against a boy. To be honest, I was a very average player on my team. It was really a challenge in terms of the level. But there was one game I was doing pretty well, and the boy who was supposed to be marking me was getting really angry. And at one point he yelled, "Get her off me, ref. I want to marry her." And of course, I was mortified as this 12-year-old girl. I was just trying to play soccer. I didn't want to have anything to do with this. And this kid was out of control, really angry, yelling all these ridiculous things. So there were some comical moments now, but at the time, I was so embarrassed.
Did having that team, the 99ers, even before the year of the World Cup, did having those women and that team as role models, was that the kind of inspiration to help you keep going and not give up?
Oh, absolutely. I remember at that point, I'm not sure I was even that aware of the male game. I don't know if I knew. I learned the female players and the Mia Hamms, Christine Lilly, Brandi Chastain, Julie Foudy. Those players were the first kind of household names I knew before I even knew of a lot of the great male players who now I consider, you know, idols as well. So I think that was always my vision. I always wanted to be a part of that team. And so that's kind of where my sights were set. So nothing that kind of happened in the meantime threw me off from that. But yeah, those players absolutely inspired me to kind of push through some of the ups and downs of youth soccer.
Well, you mentioned Brandi Chastain as one of the players that you looked up to. And thankfully for me, I managed to catch her while she was on a trip to London recently. So here she is having a chat to me about that very special moment and that very special tournament. So I'm delighted, almost honoured, to be joined by Brandi Chastain, who is, of course, a member of the famous 99ers US Women's National Team. Brandi, thank you for joining us on the show. 15 years on, would you have ever expected a bald guy with glasses from London to be questioning you about that time in your career?
No, the short answer is no. But what I have learned over these past 15 years is that how special of a team that was and how magical of an event the Women's World Cup in 1999 really was for people. And not just football fans, but general public really got behind such a wonderful event. And I think they were quite surprised how enamored they became with women's soccer. And they've never let it go.
It was quite a surreal time for you, wasn't it? I mean, I watched the 99ers ESPN documentary, which I have to say was absolutely brilliant. It's such a great insight, especially with Julie Foudy's handy camera work. But at the start of that documentary, you hear a commentator say, "The best known group of unknown women ever to captivate America." Is that how it kind of felt to you, that you went from
relative unknowns to being known all around the country?
Without a doubt. You know, the group was known to, you know, the soccer junkies, so to speak, in America, but not very much beyond that. And, you know, every community we went to, of course, there was a lot of public interaction. You know, we did a lot of charitable efforts to use fields for practice before we would play matches. We did a lot of community service. You know, for us as players, we felt that being a part of the national team was an opportunity to share soccer. It wasn't we are the national team, we stand alone on an island, and everybody has a chance to just look at us. And so I think that mentality, you know, really, I think, spread a lot of joy to people who got to see the 99 team play and that World Cup. But I think what ended up happening was it far outreached even our wildest imagination as to who would be interested in our opinion the next day. I mean, I've said many times, you know, I went from a girl from San Jose who just happened to fall into loving soccer to somebody who was asked questions about politics and world affairs and things that were totally outside of my realm of expertise, but people wanted to know my opinion, and all because I played on the women's national team. So it was an indoctrination into a world that we had never really experienced before, and maybe only Mia Hamm to that point had that kind of attention drawn to her. But I think the way the team handled it and used it as a springboard for, you know, future national team games and World Cups and Olympic Games was done so in a very careful and responsible way.
In the documentary that we referred to, Julie Foudy mentions that after you won the World Cup in 91, you came back to the States and you were greeted by three individuals, one of which being your bus driver. What do you think changed in terms of the furore and the atmosphere and the interest in you come 1999?
You know, what was so special about this group is that it was full of collegiate graduates, very smart, very thoughtful women, truly concerned about what was the best thing for women's soccer, not only here in the States, but really as a global game. And I think, honestly, just, you know, America loves an event. They love an event, and they will, you know, they want tickets to an event, and they want to see the U.S. win. They love that. Winning is, you know, a very important end result for U.S. sports fans. And so that it was that our team was successful in a very you know, I think, humble way, that it just, you know, it was embraced. And I think because of that, you know, there's a lot of us that got to do and experience things that have changed my life, have changed my teammates' lives, but all with the intention of it always coming back to women's soccer.
Did you kind of feel a responsibility on your shoulders, not just to represent women's soccer, but almost as the tournament went on and the interest grew, that you were also representing women's athletes as a whole as well?
Well, I wish I could say I was that thoughtful and that much of a visionary as it was going on. I think we were so very focused on the task at hand that's, I think, what enabled us to be successful, you know, to win a World Cup and to go through the tournament and not only win the matches, but, you know, be able to ride the waves of, you know, I scored an own goal in the quarterfinal.
I was going to ask you about that a bit later on, but yeah. We'll go on, carry on.
We can go back to it, but, you know, to ride things, waves like that, and to navigate through that, and then to come out victorious on the end, you know, it was such an amazing experience that I think, you know, people really embrace the, not just the winner part, but the total ride to, I mean, literally the momentum of that tournament was like you see the, it's like a tsunami, really. You know, it starts way out from the shore, and all of a sudden it just crashes thunderously on top of people. And it was really, and as a player, it was really overwhelming, because I think in the 99ers it says, it's like, I think we could hardly believe that we were selling out these stadiums. I think in our heart we knew it, but to actually see it was a whole nother thing.
I think one of the things that isn't covered in the documentary that I watched, and I'm not sure if anyone's spoken about it, but America's a huge country. You were selling out these big stadiums, but you had a lot of traveling to do during that tournament as well, didn't you?
Well, I think once the Women's World Cup committee, who was headed by Marla Messing out of Los Angeles, decided that the tournament was going to be nationwide instead of a regional tournament, I think that's when it would be known that the U.S. would be making the rounds. And it was, and really, I think, to our satisfaction, our responsibility, but in a responsibility not in a way that it was a burden, but more so as a right to go to the communities that had been supporting women's soccer and the women's national team as a thank you and a gift. We had traveled a lot overseas, you know, countries far and wide, and not always in the greatest circumstance. These are not four-star hotels. These are not banquet rooms. This is like brown bags and motels. And so this group was well versed on adversity and how to keep it real. So I don't think the travel really was bothersome for our group.
You coast through your group stages. You come through to the quarterfinals. You mention your own goal, and you mention in the documentary about Carla Overbeck coming over to you and saying, "Don't worry about it. You're going to help us. We're going to win this game regardless." I think you talk about how important it was at the time, but when you reflect on it, if Carla hadn't come up to you and said that, and maybe the reaction had been any different, how do you think you would have responded?
You know, I was never a player who would dwell too much on moments. Before I started as the left back on the women's national team, I was a striker. And so I think as a striker, and you are well-versed in soccer, so you know, you watch English Premier League, you've seen the likes of the best goal scorers in the world, and the best ones know how to let the miss of the goal run off their back, and they get on with the next play. So for me, I don't feel I would have dwelled too much, but I think the responsibility of making that huge of a mistake and wanting then, I know, to make a difference would have been the burden. Is, you know, maybe trying too hard to be too helpful and instead of letting the game come naturally and more organically. So, I mean, I'm grateful I only have to talk about what possibly could have happened instead of what actually happened, which was, I think, probably the greatest life lesson I've ever had on and off the soccer field. And as a mother now, I get to share with my sons and any, you know, young girls and boys teams that I work with, you know, the idea that each person truly has the ability to make an impact on somebody's life, and that we shouldn't miss that opportunity to, in a positive way, give support and encouragement. And Carla, and I told Carla a million times, and I will tell her a million more before my life is over, that I'm so grateful for her, not only her leadership, but her recognition of that moment and how she could make an impact. And I live every day trying to make that kind of impact that she made on me.
We'll come to the final in a second. One of the things that was evident from what I've read and from what I saw in the documentary was that Mia Hamm was the golden girl. She was the player that media were scrumming to try and speak to. Now, I know that there was a point made about how the team almost felt sorry for her because she was having to take that burden on her shoulders, and really all she wanted to do was get on the bus with the rest of you and join in the celebrations after a win. Was there any slight resentment by any players? And I wouldn't ask you to name anyone, but obviously you're all out there busting your backsides to try and win a game in difficult conditions, in the heat and against difficult opposition, and it's all Mia Hamm, Mia Hamm, Mia Hamm. But was there any resentment from any players, or was it a case of, do you know what, we're glad that someone's able to take the burden so that we can actually focus on the game in hand?
You know, I think that the overall resounding sentiment about what Mia gave, not on the field, but off the field, was truly appreciated, because we were clamoring, begging, pleading, on our knees at times, giving away clinics for people to recognize women's soccer. And now here we were gifted this angel, so to speak, in Mia Hamm, who captivated people's attention and did so in the way that I think even to her sometimes was baffling. You know, she is virtually, you know, in her inner circles is outgoing and funny and just wonderful, a great friend of mine. But in groups, very shy and kind of demure. And so for her to take on that in a way that was very, that wasn't self-serving, I think really led the foundation for what our team really stood for, was that we were willing to do anything, like in the 99ers, you know, if you're getting a filling, I'm going to get a filling, and so on and so on.
That advert was so cringy, honestly. I saw that and I just thought, oh my days.
But I mean, really, you know, as maybe as hokey or as silly as it may have seemed, you know, I really believe that was the feeling of our group, was, you know, if you're going to go through it, so am I. And I think Mia was the example that we needed to follow. And, you know, I hope that is looked upon by other teams, national teams or the like, as something to aspire to be.
So you overcome Brazil in the semi-finals. You face China in the final. You're underdogs, believe it or not, because you haven't had the greatest of record against China in previous meetings. How difficult was it to prepare for that game? Because the tournament had built up and built up and built up, and the interest alongside that had built up as well. The media coverage had increased. You had training sessions that were being attended by hundreds of screaming supporters. I think Tony De Chico described it as a bit of a circus, but how did the players respond to that?
You can't hear through the microphone the smile on my face. You know, I honestly believe the players were so excited. And it was like living a dream. You know, I'm happy to say that the players were, for being truly, at a time, you know, we weren't really professionals. You know, this was, you know, even though we had come off a gold medal win in Atlanta, the first time women's soccer had ever been in the Olympic Games. And, you know, there wasn't much coverage of that. And so this was a chance to really have soccer highlighted. And so, in honesty, I think we were like kids at Christmas. And we didn't know any better. But I think what was also present was that we had a great staff, our coaches and U.S. soccer. But we worked with a sports psychologist about, you know, how to, you know, when you need to be focused, you be narrowly focused. And when you can open up the filter and take things in, you open it up. But you need to know when that needs to be converted. And I think our team got really good at, this is here, now it's important, you know, narrow it in. Here, you know, after a game, okay, open up, see your family, see your friends, celebrate, high five, you know. And, you know, I really think it was I mean, I'm almost speechless because it was so unreal. The momentum, as I said earlier, and the attention, totally unexpected, but totally naturally and genuinely appreciated and enjoyed. And I think that's why this team, there was no premonition, there was no preconceived notion that we're going to get all this attention and adulation and I'm going to walk around with my chest puffed out and I'm better than everybody else. Not even a thought in the world about that. It was just joy. It was like kids playing soccer at the local park. You know, when you play with your buddies, your pub friends, and you're playing a pickup game, you know. It was that much fun.
We all know what happened in the final. you've been asked a million times about that penalty, that moment where you ripped your shirt off, so I'm not even going to bother repeating it. But the question that I'd have, and I'm not sure if it's been asked before or it certainly wasn't mentioned in the documentary that I saw, how did your life change after that?
Well, I think the first thing that I can truly close my eyes and remember is how exhausted I was. I don't think there was much sleep for at least a week. You know, our team went from coast to coast. You know, we had played on the East Coast, and we went to the West Coast for the final. Then we went to Disneyland, and we went to New York City. Then we went to Cape Canaveral for a shuttle launch. And we just were all over the place. And I don't sleep much now, and I didn't sleep much then. But I remember thinking, I don't want to close my eyes because I don't want to miss a moment of all this excitement. And I think in saying that, what I thought was pretty amazing was the outlets in which women's soccer was now being spoken, you know, whether it was on late night television or, you know, serious news channels, or, you know, being asked to have a motivational speech to a Fortune 500 company, you know, speak to elementary school. I mean, everything just started flying at you at lightning speed. And so I think it was overwhelming at times because, you know, when you're asked questions that are not in your wheelhouse or your comfort zone or in your profession, you know, it can be intimidating. And luckily, I think, for our group, that social media was not in the picture. And it allowed us to be genuine. And I think, unfortunately, now social media is, we don't see a lot of genuineness anymore. It's manufactured and it's edited. And this was a different time, for sure.
I'm going to finish on a quote by the president at the time, Bill Clinton, who said, "It was the most exciting sports event I think I've ever seen. We learnt a lot today about soccer and women's athletes. I cannot thank you enough for the gift that you have given to the United States." When you hear that, how proud does that make you?
I mean, it actually puts a lump in my throat. It reminds me of all the good things that each of the players that played on that 99 team have done since that time. The contribution that they've made to the communities that they live in, that what they've done to promote women's soccer in our country and globally, to allow for young women to dream and aspire, maybe not to be a professional footballer, but maybe to be the doctor of the team or the lawyer or the general manager or maybe the coach. You know, what happened from that time, and that quote specifically, we represented ourselves, our team, and the sport in a way that we could hold our heads high and know that we did it together with all the best intention and in a way that we could be just, we could look back and be so proud.
I don't think there's a better way to end this interview. Brandy, really appreciate it. It was a nice opportunity to speak to you about an iconic event. Thank you for joining us on the Women's Football Podcast.
It has been my pleasure, and go City.
The Women's Football Podcast.
Follow the podcast on Twitter
at WFPod.
Okay, so that was Brandy Chastain giving some great insight into what it was like to be part of that World Cup winning side. Yeah, one of the things I wanted to pick up on was a quote that I used at the end of Brandy's interview, where Bill Clinton was on the 99ers ESPN film that was broadcast in the States, and we managed to see it over here in the UK. And he said, "It was the most exciting sports event I think I've ever seen. We learned a lot about soccer and female athletes. I cannot thank you enough for the gift you have given the United States." I asked Brandy what it was like, and she said it's, you know, put a lump in her throat. When you've got the President of the United States saying that about women's soccer, that must be really encouraging to have the President saying something like that. I mean, it would be great if Barack Obama was saying that next year if the US win the World Cup.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's something really special when, you know, all of us as young soccer players can appreciate the women's national team. It's everyone's goal. They're all the young players' idols. But I think when that transcends the soccer field and these women become true celebrities and heroes of the country, that's when it's really special. And I think we saw that in 99. You know, I remember after that, or even during the tournament, the women who I looked up to on the field were all in commercials on TV, and it looked really glamorous. And just to know that, you know, the president of the country was paying attention and valued their contribution as representing our country, that's huge. So I think that's when, as a young player, it kind of strikes you as, oh, wow, they're really famous and really, really heroes of our country.
Why do you think there was such a celebrity status attached to them over any other team that played before or maybe even since then?
Well, I think, first of all, our country loves winners. So that's number one. And that team was a team of winners. I don't know what their record was through that year and the build-up to the tournament, but I think we all remember them as just dominating women's soccer. And that's when the U.S., I think, really made our mark as being dominant in the world of women's soccer, as well as just having the tournament in our country. You know, especially at that time, I think it's hard if it's overseas to televise the games, especially if there's a time difference. So the fact that the tournament was here and in these big football stadiums, you know, American football stadiums, with thousands of people watching the games and cheering, I think just all made a really lasting impact.
What do you remember about the tournament as a young 12-year-old?
Well, I was actually at the opening game. It was either the opening game or the U.S.'s opening game in what was Giant Stadium in New Jersey. I remember seeing Mia Hamm score the first goal of the tournament, which was really exciting because, you know, history was being made. And at that time, you know, I was so removed from it. It was my goal to play on that team, but I was very far removed from the day that that would maybe be a possibility. So I was in the audience in my, you know, U.S. national team jersey cheering like anyone else and just completely blown away by the level of play and the fact that there were so many people there watching and cheering as well.
As a 12-year-old who we've already discussed earlier, playing with boys, struggling to win the respect of opposition players and parents as well, when you saw over that tournament as it gradually got bigger and bigger and bigger and the interest grew, did something in your head kind of think, do you know what, there is a reason why I took up this sport and there is a reason why I want to carry it on and this is the exact reason?
Yeah, I think that it really kind of solidified in my mind what I was aiming towards. You know, it's easy to say, oh, I want to be a professional soccer player. And I would always say that in school or when my family or relatives asked, what do you want to do when you grow up? I would say a professional soccer player. And they didn't really get it. They looked at me like, okay, that's like saying you want to be a princess or something. You know, some kids make up funny things they want to be when they grow up. But I remember actually being at our family reunion that summer in 99, and the final was about to be on TV. So of course, myself and my family were really into it and watching the final. And some of the extended family started to come into the room and kind of see, you know, what is this all about? And I think it kind of, in my mind, I was showing them, you know what, this is what I want to do. I'm not just saying I want to be this thing when I grow up. This is actually real. I want to be like these women there. And I remember watching the shootout and my mom was so tense and nervous. I think my mom started crying and I was really embarrassed. But it was just a really exciting moment. And it was exciting because all of a sudden, the thing I was saying I wanted to be, and as my career, you know, was visible for people, that's what I wanted to do right there, what everyone was watching those women doing at that moment.
Well, you mentioned your mum crying there. For those that don't know, she has quite a good relationship with Brandi Chastain, doesn't she? Because she actually wrote Brandi's book. Tell me how they know each other and how that came about.
Yeah, so years later, my mom is an author, has written many books on running and health and fitness, and then later got into the soccer world through me. And I'm not actually sure how she met Brandi in particular, but she had co-authored a couple soccer books with coaches, one of them being Anson Dorrance, the UNC coach, and then co-authored Brandi's book, and so got to know her really well through that, because, you know, to write a book with someone, you have to go interview them multiple times, see how they live, hear them speak about what they do, and really, you know, capture their voice. So Brandi ended up being a really good friend of the family later on, but at that point, you know, we didn't know these players as anything besides heroes and role models.
So you mentioned that you had all the extended family all sat around the television watching that final. When it went to penalties, how did you feel, and how tense was it in that living room?
Oh, it's actually so hard to remember the emotion of it. I don't think, to be honest, my extended family had any idea what they were watching or even knew which team was which. But I remember, I always love watching celebrations and those moments, you know, when the winning team, just that moment right after they won the game, whether the final whistle blows or, like, in this case, when Brandy scored her penalty kick, those moments always give me chills. So I remember watching, and my mom was crying. I was probably, I don't even know what I was thinking, but I love to see that moment of joy when all the hard work has paid off and you can, you know, celebrate together and lift the trophy. So I can imagine it was very emotional for all of us.
Well, I guess the final question I'd ask before we go to our second interview is, did you notice a change in attitude from the boys and the parents that you were playing with and in front of after that World Cup win? Did you find that they were a bit more respectful because the US women's national team had just achieved something so great?
I don't know. I always found that my team was respectful from the get-go, to be honest. But I think that it just brought women's soccer to the forefront and people were aware of it. So people were, for a while, you know, making jokes about when they score goals, if they ripped off their shirt, they were doing a Brandy Chastain, whether it was a girl or a boy with no sports bra anyway. But it just became, you know, a household name. So what I was watching and looking up to before now was kind of out there and everybody knew about it. So I didn't have to feel weird if I, you know, made a reference to, said something about Mia Hamm. I knew that everybody knew who she was. Or if I said, oh, that's like Brandy Chastain, everybody knew at that point, which was kind of a cool feeling because, you know, our women's team at that point was probably more well-known than the men's national team just because of the success of the program.
Well, absolutely. And one person who knew how successful that team was the man who was heading it all up. And I managed to speak to him recently. And it's quite a long interview, but I think people will be very interested to hear what he's got to say. So here is the former head coach of the US Women's National Team and a gold medal winner, Tony DiCicco. Okay, so it's an honour to be joined for our second interview by the US Women's National Team coach of the 99 World Cup winning team, Tony DiCicco. Tony, thank you very much for joining me.
My pleasure. I always look forward to talking about that team.
Well, let's go a little bit before that 99 team, because obviously you came off the back of a gold medal winning performance at the Atlanta Olympics in 96, the first Olympics to host women's soccer. How significant and how important do you think that win in 96 was in terms of the build-up to the 99 World Cup?
Well, it was very, very important because I think before the Olympic women's football competition, U.S. Soccer and the organizing committee for the 99 World Cup was considering kind of the same way Sweden did the World Cup in 1995, smaller stadiums, 5 to 10,000 seat stadiums, kind of a regional event, probably East Coast event versus national event. But the interest generated in the 96 Olympics, including, you know, the gold medal game against China with over 77,000 people in attendance, I think changed their mind. And they decided to go to NFL stadiums, the same stadiums that the men had used in 1994 when they hosted the World Cup then. So it was a big decision for U.S. Soccer and the organizing committee. They came to me and they said, you know, we're going to take this to big stadiums, but we need you to agree to some things. One is that your team will have to travel every game. So that ideally the U.S. team will be seen in every venue if you can get to the final. And I agreed to that, but I also said that, well, then every team needs to travel every game so that we're not the only team that's, you know, traveling cross-country and within interregional.
So with that decided just before the tournament, you're building up, you're playing your friendly matches to try and gain the experience. Then comes the time to pick your squad. Now, looking at the team and the squad that you picked, it was made up very largely of that 96 gold medal winning team, but a few of those players had played in the 95 World Cup and even some of them in the 91 World Cup. You then bring in young players like the likes of Christy Pearce, who is obviously the only surviving member in terms of who's still playing now for the US women's national team. For those that don't know, she was obviously now Christy Rampone. You bring in the other young players like Laurie Fur. What was your thinking when you were picking that squad in terms of trying to go into that tournament?
Well, I think it's every coach would probably agree with this statement, is that you're not always picking the best 21 players, I think it was 21 in that tournament, but the best team. So it was a case where we wanted, some veteran players. We had veteran leadership on the bench that weren't starters, like Tisha Venturini. But we also had young, exciting players that were going to learn a lot from being part of that World Cup. So, I mean, there was some question marks. Is, you know, in every player selection situation, people questioned some of the players we let go and some of the players we kept. But I was very confident that we had a great team selected.
Was there any doubt in your mind about picking any of the veterans? Was there any question marks in your head that some of them may have been a bit too settled and you wanted to maybe freshen things up a bit more than you did?
No, not really. I mean, there was some movement after the 96 Olympics. Players like Karen Gabera retired, and there was a few others. But I think leading up to 99, our veteran core was still fairly young. They were, you know, except for Michelle Akers, I think they were all still in their 20s. So it wasn't a case where I was looking to move any players on and make room for younger players. I think we had the core. In fact, I was trying to keep players on board, like Michelle Akers, moving her from center forward into a holding midfield position to extend her career. Even though it took her farther away from goal and she's one of the all-time leading goal scorers in international history, it was a case where we could extend her career by putting her in the midfield.
I was going to ask you about Michelle because I read about the fact that you moved her from a kind of forward position to a more sort of anchoring the midfield kind of role. How did she respond to that? Was that something that she was open to, or was it something that she had to kind of get used to?
Well, we first talked about it. We were in Brazil for a tournament in 98. And I said, Michelle, we need help in the midfield, and I want to move you into the midfield. And at first, she wasn't happy with it because she looked at it as a demotion. And then the next time we spoke, I said, listen, you know, I think I can extend your career if you play in the midfield. And that kind of, you know, was eye-opening for her because she wanted to continue playing. And she's incredibly technical. You know, she could play balls inside of right foot, inside of left foot, outside of right foot, outside of left foot. She could deal with balls in traffic. She would tell me, it's easy to play here because I can see it all. I'm not playing back to goal with players coming in and kicking me from behind. And, you know, her warrior mentality is legendary. So when balls were played in that area of the field, no one was going to win it other than Michelle Akers.
So you go into the tournament. You, let's be honest, you glide through your group matches. During the early stages of the competition, when was it that you started to realise, number one, this is a really, really special team and we could create something really magic here, and number two, how big the interest was starting to grow in the team and the tournament as a whole?
Yeah, well, I mean, as far as the team being special, and our goal was to win the World Cup. We hadn't done it in 95. We felt like we failed. So, and I'm big in setting big dreams and big goals. So there was never any question in any of our minds that we were capable of winning it. And that was our objective, to you know, beat the rest of the world. And as we got closer, we started to realize that there was some special interest being generated. Leading up to the first game, we were training. The first game was in Giant Stadium in New York, and we were training in New Jersey, and we started to get requests from Dave Letterman for interviews, and I think he requested Mia. Mia didn't want to go. His second request was Brandy, and we sent Brandy. But I can remember Aaron at the beginning of that week as we started training saying, you know, we're getting close to sell out, and then as the week progressed, there's only 5,000 tickets left. It sold out, and so we knew that it was getting to become a big event. And we also knew that if we didn't win, if we didn't continue in the tournament, it would probably just fizzle out. So there was a lot of pressure on the team. I always feel that the home team has pressure. We've seen it recently with Brazil. The expectations are high. We try to use phrases, and we talked about the pressure. Pressure is a privilege. Pressure is an opportunity. So I had a great sports psychologist and Dr. Colleen Hacker, and we spent time addressing that. But at the end of the day, this team only had one goal. It was to win. It was to dominate in every game if possible, and that's how we went into the tournament.
When you're getting requests from people like David Letterman, it must be quite surreal. How much of a distraction, if it was indeed a distraction, was it when you're trying to prepare for a major tournament, when your only goal is to win that World Cup, and you're getting media requests like that? And obviously, as I said, I saw the ESPN documentary that was put together, and the media interest at your training sessions, an example, it looked like absolute chaos. I mean, how much of a distraction was that when you're trying to prepare this team for important games?
I mean, it's a distraction, but you either want that distraction because the event is big, or you don't get that distraction because nobody really cares. So, I mean, it's, you know, obviously we want it to be a big event. We wanted to have an event that was the biggest ever in women's sports. And so that kind of came with the territory. And as I said, Mia was requested first, but Mia felt that it was too much of a distraction. Brandy, and you've met Brandy, Brandy's nickname was Hollywood. If I ever did not let Brandy know that she was requested by David Letterman and she found out later, it would have probably taken her off her game. So I said, yes, we'll send Brandy. Aaron, you're going to travel with her. We need a car service in and back, you know, because we were about an hour outside of, you know, Manhattan. So we just had to manage those sort of things. But obviously, when Dave Letterman came on board, he was great at promoting the event, promoting the team, and not just for that one game, but throughout the whole tournament.
So as I mentioned earlier, you glide through the group games pretty comprehensively, and then you come up against a very strong, very physical Germany side. You obviously go behind very early for an unfortunate Brandy own goal. You go in at halftime behind. What did you say to the team that made them come out so quickly in the second half and overcome that physical, strong Germany side?
Well, first of all, coaches never feel like they glide through anything. The first game against Denmark ended up 3-0, but it was closer than that. The next game against Nigeria, they actually scored first, but then we had a great response. And even the game against North Korea, where I felt we were going to win our group, rested players, played pretty much the bench, but even they had some opportunities, was 0-0 at halftime. So you never tell a coach that they're gliding through games. But now we had to play Germany. And Germany, unfortunately, I had requested every team travel after every game. Germany had played their third game, group game in Washington, D.C., and now they were waiting for us. We traveled from Boston to Washington, and this was the German dream team. This is a team that I dreaded that would, you know, the Marin Meinarts that were injured at one time or another, they all got together. This is a team that I felt was clearly one of the strongest in the world, and the fact that they won the 2003 and 2007 World Cups would indicate that. We knew we were going to have a battle. And to go down early showed the U.S. resolve, coming back, tying it 1-1, and then Vitina Wegman hit a great goal just at the stroke of halftime. So we went in down 2-1, and I don't remember everything I said. I remember saying to them, don't let your dream end here. And we made our tactical adjustments, but we didn't want to panic them. We knew we had a half. We knew we were fit. We knew we had a lot of firepower. And the fact that we scored on two corner kicks was very rewarding because, you know, we prided ourselves at being good on set pieces, both offensively and defensively. And the fact that Brandy scored the tying goal on the first corner kick in the second half was a great relief to her because obviously she had suffered the own goal in the first half.
So you come through that one. Your mix of youth and experience is clearly evident in the semi-final as you obviously beat Brazil 2-0 with Cindy Parlow and one of your young players and your experienced veteran, Michelle Akers, getting the two goals. And then obviously the big day arrives. China, who have overcome your nemesis, Norway, 5-0 in their semi-final. One of the favourites for the tournament. They have the player that was named eventually player of the tournament, Sun Wen. Going into that final, I know it's a long time ago, but what was the build-up like? What was the tension in the squad like? And was there even an opportunity to kind of enjoy it because of the tension and the pressure that you mentioned earlier in being the home team?
Well, yeah, I think the tension was greatly reduced after the quarterfinal win against Germany. The quarterfinal, to me, is the toughest game because you're obviously in the tournament, you're in the knockout stage, you're so close to your goals, but if you lose in the quarterfinal, the next day FIFA just sends you home. I mean, it's free fall. And so, after the quarterfinal, I think the team was able to take a deep breath and relax a bit and now know there's only two matches left. And the game against Brazil was, a good game for us, but Brianna Scurry, our goalkeeper, as Brazil came on very strongly in the second half as they could with players like Pertinha and Cici and, Rosalie and stuff. Brianna Scurry was just awesome and made some great saves, and we won that game 2-0. So now we've got the final. I think there's not as much pressure as people would think. We're at the final. This is what we wanted to be at. China was a fantastic team. In fact, after the game, when we won in penalty kicks and I was interviewed by ABC, I said, in my mind, there was two champions on the field. And I meant that sincerely, that they were champions as well. They had beaten us twice that year. In one game, they beat us 2-1 in Portugal, and Brandy Chastain had missed a penalty. When it was 1-1, we would have probably won that game. And then we played twice in the United States. We beat them 2-1, and they, a few days later, they beat us 2-1. So teams were close. They were a fantastic team. It was the first time, really, that I felt that their mentality matched the USA women's mentality. Usually we dominated them a little bit from a mental side, and I'm not sure what they did that year, but they were our equal from a mentality standpoint. So we knew it was going to be a difficult game. And obviously with Soon Nguyen, who was a fantastic player, we were going to need to control her. And, I kind of look at that game a little bit like the semifinal we just saw in Brazil, Argentina against Netherlands. The two teams respected their attacking personalities so much that, it wasn't like I don't believe Coach Ma set up to be a real defensive game, and I didn't set it up to be a real defensive game. But I think the respect of each other's attack by the players on both teams forced them to be over conscientious defensively. And so just as we saw Argentina and Netherlands not really produce a lot of goal scoring opportunities, that's how that game unfolded, China versus the USA.
Is that one of those situations where in the group games, you have to go for it a little bit more because obviously you need the points to qualify for the knockout stages. But once you get to the knockout stages, it's that balance of you are desperate to win, but arguably you are even more desperate not to lose. And I guess that's where that respect comes in, where you don't want to overdo the attacking element of the game so that you leave yourself exposed at the back.
Yeah, I mean, our team was an attacking team, and for sure China just dismantled Norway 5-0, so they're an attacking team. And I've tried to say, what did I do in training sessions leading up to that? I remember doing one training session when we talked about our defensive shape and, players' responsibilities from that shape. But at the same time, I wanted us to be a little bit more adventurous in the attack. And again, they were great defensively. We were great defensively, and just nullified the Mia Hams and the Soon Wins were nullified in that game. But it was, it was very hot in Pasadena. The players, both teams, were incredibly fit, and they fought for 120 minutes.
So you go through 120 minutes in that stifling heat that you've mentioned. It goes to penalty kicks. You've lost Michelle Akers at the start of extra time. So your first penalty taker likely is off the field. How did you go about picking your penalty takers? There's been a lot of media coverage. You've mentioned the Holland-Argentina game. It's been well publicised that no Holland player wanted to take the first penalty kick against Argentina, and Ron Vlaar, the centre-back with no penalty experience, had to take it. What situation were you presented with when it went to penalties with your players?
Well, I'd like to think we were more prepared than that, to be perfectly honest, because I didn't know when this team was going to have to move on or win through a penalty kick shootout, but I knew eventually it would happen. And we worked from a mental side for years. This is not just this year, because in the Olympics we had these same discussions that, and it all started in 1991. In 1991, if we ever had to go to penalties, we were ill-prepared. None of the players wanted to take a penalty. And I saw that as an assistant coach. And so when I took over as head coach, I addressed that. And I said, look, you don't have that luxury to say, oh, I don't want to take a penalty. I don't want that responsibility. You just don't have that luxury. If you're in the game, you have to be prepared mentally to take a penalty, and you have to be prepared mentally to make a penalty. And that's the only way it is. So, because I heard Hope Powell in 2011, when that went to penalties, nobody wanted to take a penalty.
So she said, yeah.
Zoe Smith. That is not acceptable. Now, I also think that we prepared for this because my assistant coach, Lauren Gregg, and we didn't overdo penalties, but as we were leading up to the competition, we would play friendlies against boys' teams or even other women's teams or international teams. We'd ask to take penalties at the end. And so we started charting who our penalty takers were and who performed the best. And you know how it is. You can never replicate that same pressure. So the night before, when the coaches met, we talked about penalties the night before the final. And we all knew that Michelle Akers was likely not going to be in the game after 120 minutes, so we didn't even include her in the lineup. And most of the discussion came, it was talk about Mia Hamm. Mia didn't really want to take a penalty, but you know, at that time she was the all-time leading goal scorer in international history, and there was no way I was going to leave that player on the bench. And the biggest discussion was on Brandi Chastain, because Brandi had been one of our best penalty kickers over 5 or 6 years, but in 1999, she didn't have a good year in penalties. She was kind of scouted. She always hit it right-footed to the goalkeeper's right. And so I met with her, and I said, look, let's start taking him to the goalkeeper's left. And she struggled with that. As technical as she wasn't good at that. So I said, well, can you take him lefty? She says, yeah. She was my left back, so she was very good with both feet. I said, all right, you got to practice them both righty and lefty. So that night before, to be honest with you, Lauren Gregg didn't think she should take a penalty. I thought she should take a penalty, and my other coach, Jay Hoffman, was kind of caught in between. So anyway, we were fairly close to what our penalty shooters were going to be, obviously dependent on who was in the match. So as we went into added time, I said to Lauren, okay, draw up the penalty list as you think. And so at the end of the game, she brought it to me, and I liked what it had. It had our captain, our leader, somebody who had played a great game, like Clark did, but it was also a center back leading us off. And you got to remember, Carla was a mother. So, you know, giving birth is probably anything else after giving birth is probably a lot, it's pretty easy. Our second penalty kicker was Joy Fawcett, mother of two. It was our right back, but a very talented player. And so I liked everything I saw, except she had Julie Foudy fifth and Brandi sixth. So I said, flip those two. And I said, go to Brandi and see if she wants to take a penalty. And I knew she would. Tell her, you know, she needs to take it left-footed. And so Lauren went up to her, said she'd take the penalty. Lauren said, will you take it left-footed? Because I just needed Gao Hong to see something different. She said she would. And so we had our penalty kick shootout. Now, Julie Foudy's never forgiven me when she's heard that story. But, you know, Mia was at first upset, and we just told her, we need you to take a penalty, and we have confidence in you. And I think she was fine after that. So it went Carla, who is so, if you see the video, Carla strolls up, kind of flicks the ball up from the ground into her hands. I've never seen her more relaxed. And then she buries it. You know, she gets Gao Hong going one way and puts it the other side. Joy Fawcett, same thing. And I think the third one was Christine Lilly, buries it in the upper corner. And then Mia. And, you know, they were all confident. They took great penalties. And again, everyone needs to be prepared to take a penalty and prepared to make a penalty. And that is in my pregame notes, you know, my flip chart notes before the game, you know, our offensive and defensive sets, that statement on penalties is in there. And all I can say is you do not want to have a penalty kick shootout with the USA women on July 10th, because that was July 10th, and July 10th in 2011 was when the U.S. had that historic goal from Abby Wambach, and then went to penalties with Brazil. And in both cases, we scored all five. So that's a bad date to get into a penalty kick shootout with the United States.
You mentioned Brandy's nickname was Hollywood. Was it rather fitting then that she was the player that scored the decisive kick to win the World Cup? And while there is no question the whole squad is well remembered and well respected, that it's her face and her moment that kind of the image of her ripping her shirt off, which, you know, people talk about, is kind of the image that people have of that winning side.
Yeah, in many ways it was kind of Brandy's tournament. I thought she was unbelievable that year in preparation. She was fitter than she ever was. Then she has the Dave Letterman show at the beginning of the tournament. Then she has the own goal in the middle of the tournament. And then she has the winning penalty kick at the end of the tournament. But here's what you have to know about Brandy. Brandy, and I say this to young players when, you know, at my camps and stuff, Brandy Chastain scored that goal probably 1,000 times. But 999 were in her mind, you know, where she was playing somewhere and she said, okay, winning penalty kick. And you know, I think to be an outward champion, you have to be an inner winner first. And so that's the player you want stepping up in that situation. She took it lefty. A lot of people don't know that story because when she pulled off her shirt, that became the story. And she buried it in the side netting. And it was the perfect player to hit a perfect penalty in the perfect moment in women's football.
Now, we know about a lot of the players and their feelings after that game, and obviously they still talk about it now because people like myself ask them the question, and as I said, I've spoken to Brandy about it on this show. But what about for you? You'd won a gold medal in 96, but how special was it for you to lift that World Cup?
That was incredibly special. I mean, first of all, it made us Olympic champions and World Cup champions at the same time. Secondly, we had failed in 95, and that's how we felt. We had failed in 95 in Sweden, and now this was redemption, so they were world champions. And then when you look at the scope of the event, how, you know, the stories I heard, look, I can remember where I was 9/11, and I can remember where I was when John F. Kennedy was killed, and I'm older than you, but people would tell me, I'll never forget where I was when you guys won that game. And, you know, the stories we heard post-event. And I think, you know, as far as the growth of the women's sports, women's football internationally, that had a big statement to make. And domestically, and I don't know if you recall, but the U.S. World Cup team in France in 1998 was a disgrace, quite honestly. Didn't get out of group play, but that isn't the biggest problem. The biggest problem was there was a lot of infighting in the team, coaches calling out players in the press, players calling out the coach, each other. It was a terrible time. And to be honest with you, U.S. soccer was going to lose all their sponsors because it was an embarrassment. We came in 32 out of 32 teams. And after this win, not only did U.S. soccer keep all their sponsors, which is pretty important, but obviously a whole new group of sponsorship came in to U.S. soccer. So I think it was a great impetus to keep the sport growing in this country, not only from the fact that more and more kids signed up to play the game, but from a business standpoint that U.S. soccer was able to continue to do and spend money in the sport.
Well, it's fascinating insight. I guess my final question would be, we've seen players like Abby Wambach, Alex Morgan, Megan Rapinoe. The list is endless since that team in 99 won the World Cup. Some amazing teams who've won gold medals at Olympic Games, and I'm almost certain that it's not long before the US win another World Cup. But why do you think people still talk about that 99 team, and why is it that they were so instrumental in inspiring so many young kids to take up the game and really push the game on in the States?
I think there's a number of reasons. One is we played an attractive brand of soccer. It might not have been Barcelona, but we were a team that wanted to play possession, kept the ball, probed with possession, and then, you know, try to set up a personality player like Mia Hamm or Tiffany Milbert one-on-one with somebody and then tore defenses apart. I think that that team played sport like Americans appreciate, you know, with talent, with tremendous work ethic, find a way to win mentality, humble when they win, respectful when they lost. This is what Americans value in their sports heroes, and that team had it. And then it was the girl next door syndrome. I mean, you've met Brandy and Mia and Christine. These are not towering athletes. These are the girls next door. And they're not big, but again, if you think of the great years of Barcelona and Spain where you had the Iniestas and the Xavis running around, quick, tough, and that's what this team was like. Yeah, they had their warrior-type players with Michelle Akers, but it was a team that people could relate to. And then if you went to games, these players took the responsibility of being role models, of signing autographs. Brandy was the best at this. She would sign autographs until every single person was had an autograph if they wanted it. It could take a couple hours. We'd have to pull her into the bus so we could get back and get a meal in and stuff. But they were all like that. And so that's why America fell in love with that team and still feels a strong connection with that team. The current team is a phenomenal team. I coached Alex Morgan, Sidney LaRue, Megan Klingenberg, Kelly O'Hare, and a bunch of them, you know, but I coached that group in Chile in 2008. We won a world championship as a U-20 team. And I can't say that the U.S. team from 1999 is any better than the current team as an attacking team. This team has so many weapons in attack. Megan Rapinoe, Heather O'Reilly, Abby Wambach, and Kristen Press, and go on and on and on. And our team had tremendous attacking personalities, too. And I know there's always discussion about which team is better. I just want our team to have a great World Cup in Canada and do what we did, be Olympic gold medalist champions and World Cup champions at the same time. And I think they're capable of doing it. I'm hoping Jill Ellis makes the makes the correct moves. I think we got to improve the defense a little bit and that we get it done in Canada.
Well, Tony, it's been a fascinating insight into that World Cup team. I'm just looking at my recorder and it's a half an hour interview, but I think people won't mind that at all. It's been absolutely, you know, great to speak to you and an absolute pleasure. And thank you very much for joining me on the show.
Kiernan, thanks very much. I appreciate it and look forward to catching up in person sometime.
Download and subscribe to the show on iTunes.
Just search for Women's Football Podcast.
So that was Tony DiCicco with some very in-depth insight into that 99 World Cup winning side. Yeah, one of the things I wanted to pick up on was Tony was quite complimentary of the current US Women's National Team squad. He obviously said that he didn't feel that the 99 team was any more talented than the one that currently plays under Jill Ellis. But I guess one of the things I'd ask is, what do you think it is that made that team so successful, and what do you think, and I'd include yourself in this, being a player that's in and around the squad, what do you think the current squad needs to do to get over that finish line and potentially win a World Cup in Canada next year?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting to look at how the women's game has changed and evolved, and at the same time what has stayed the same. And I think that the U.S. is known for having the mentality of winning and a very cohesive group that, you know, fights to the end, a very competitive team. And one thing I do think was different with the 99 team than maybe today is that because there was possibly less competition to make the, either it was, I don't know if it was 18, 20, 21, whatever the roster was at that time in 99, I think the group was extremely cohesive. Not that it isn't today, but today you have a slightly larger pool of players who could potentially play at that level and do a good job. So there's constant competition for those spots. There's new players in and out of training camps, you know, including myself trying to make that team. You always have the same core of players, but in 99 you really had probably a very tight-knit group that had been together as a group for a large part of the process leading up to the tournament. And so with that, I think you can develop a kind of competitiveness within the team, and just a will to win and a real cohesiveness on the field. Not that you can't do that today, but I think maybe was a little bit easier in 99, as well as the fact that if you look at just the state of women's soccer at the time, I think I don't want to take away at all from what the 99 team accomplished, but the women's game has grown tremendously. So today, when you look at a World Cup tournament, there are no easy games. Almost any team involved in the tournament could progress out of the group and could challenge to win. So I think you have a slightly more competitive playing field throughout the world and within the U.S., which has just changed the dynamic of our own team and the World Cup in general.
Going back to what we were talking about earlier, you grew up following this team. You've already mentioned the fact that you looked up to the likes of Brandi Chastain and Christine Lilly and Mia Hamm. You got to live out your dream in 2007 when you made your debut for the US Women's National Team in China against my home team, England. What do you remember about that?
Well, it's funny because I remember in the lead up to the games in that tournament in China, I knew that one of them might be my first cap, my first appearance. So I purposely didn't listen to my iPod or anything on the way to the games because I wanted to remember every little detail. I looked out the window. I wanted to remember what it looked like, what it sounded like, what it felt like. But ironically, I remember very little. I think probably because my nerves have impaired my memory. But I think England was our second game of the tournament, and I knew that any one of those games, I may be going in and getting my first cap. So towards the end of the game, I was told to go warm up because I was going in. And, you know, it was one of those moments where the emotional and mental part of it and my nerves and anxiety in the situation, I think, made my legs so shaky. I can't even remember how I even ran out onto the field. But the second I got out there, although it was an incredibly special moment, I remember it dawning on me, you know what, this is just a normal game, got to get the ball, pass, do the things I would usually do, and I kind of fell into the rhythm of that. But at the same time, afterwards and beforehand, I really did appreciate what it means to pull on that jersey. I think I still have that jersey, the first jersey I wore. It was actually, funny enough, it was number 20, which is now Abby Wambach's number. And was at the time, but she actually wasn't at that tournament. So I got to, I think because I'm a similar size to her, I got to fill in wearing her jersey. So I think I still have that jersey at home. And obviously that's a moment I won't forget ever.
So you achieved your dream to represent your country. Would the next kind of dream be that in 15 years' time, people are talking about your US Women's National Team having won a World Cup like we are talking about the 99ers?
Oh, I think absolutely. It's definitely harder today. I think there's just because of, there's more competition within the world of women's soccer, and other countries are now investing a lot of money in programming to prepare to win the World Cup as well. Not that they weren't in 99, but I just think the game has evolved. So it's not the same as it was, but I think that we have the potential right now as a country to really make a mark on the women's game. With the amount of talent and athleticism our current U.S. Women's National Team has, I think that we are capable of playing the game in a way that the world of women's soccer has never seen. And I've seen glimpses of it, you know, in the times I've been in training camps and been in games with the team. I just think I constantly am awed by the combination of skill and athleticism that our team presents, and not only within those starting 11 players, but the bench players, as well as even the general pool of players. You know, sometimes you'll have a camp of 30 people just in for a training camp, and just the general quality and level of play is absolutely mind-boggling at times.
I couldn't agree more. Well, I think that's the perfect way to end this show. I think it's been great to have you on, Yale, to give us an insight into what it was like growing up following that 99 team and going on to achieve your own dream of representing your country. Before I finish, I do have a competition and I have a signed shirt to give away, thankfully to Yale. She has agreed to give away that number 20 shirt that she wore on her first cap. So thank you very much for that, Yale. That's much appreciated.
Yeah, I don't remember saying that before the show. It's funny.
No, I'm joking. I wouldn't do that to you. I would not do that. That's a cherished item that I'm sure she will keep forever. No, I do have a signed US Women's National Team jersey that has been autographed by Brandi Chastain and by Laurie Fair, two of the members of that US Women's National Team from 99. It's not a worn jersey. I actually think the jersey is from the mid-2000s, but I can assure you that the autographs on there are both genuine. And to win that jersey, you need to answer a question that Yale is going to give you now. So, Yale, fire away.
Okay, so I have, as of now, scored one and only one international goal for the U.S. Women's National Team, and you have to tell us who that goal was scored against.
So that's all you have to do, guys. You just need to email the wfpod@gmail.com. So that's thewfpod@gmail.com, and put in the subject line WFPod competition and tell us who Yale Averbuch scored her one and only international goal against. And I'll give you till the 31st of July to get your entries in, and I will pick a winner at random on a future show. So get your emails in. So nothing left for me to do other than to thank you, Yale. You've been an absolute star. Thank you for coming on the show again.
Oh, my pleasure. I love talking about the game, so anytime.
Lovely. And obviously thank you to Brandi and to Tony for coming on this special show, and I will speak to you all very soon.
The Women's Football Podcast,
shining a light on the women's game.